Yeah, like when you were doing smack talk, you know, that wasn't on a schedule. You did it when you had stuff to talk about.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So we're going to be talking a little bit about his, how he got started in the hobby, a little bit of all kinds of stuff. I think he's, this is an interesting guy we have here today. So you ready to roll the intro?
Let's do it.
Let's get it going. Welcome to episode number 25. And today we actually have a guest. Looking forward to it. What do you think, Kyle?
This is awesome. Special guest indeed.
Yeah. And you know what? We've been struggling for content. I'm very happy that our friend showed up today.
Yeah.
He's my neighbor. He lives down the road. He just moved to my backyard. Well, not really. He's got a very big backyard himself. But yeah, he moved pretty close. And it's good to have him. How you doing, Carrie Shirley?
I'm doing very well, guys. How are you today?
We're doing good. We're slow. This is a slow time of year. What can I say?
I bet it hasn't been.
No, last weekend was very busy. But you know what? It's good. It's just taking a little break. And you made a comment earlier when we were in the kitchen. And you said that this was the best Thanksgiving you've had in a while. Tell us why.
Well, for the last 10 years... Mr. Kammerer and I have put together this little shindig called the Orlando Helicopter Blowout, and it's actually been a commercial event, which we actually started planning in February of each year. So it took hundreds of hours from both of us to make that thing work as it did. Towards the end, it ran very smoothly. We didn't really have a lot of problems. Everything was kind of like clockwork, but still took a lot of time. So, and that always took place right after Thanksgiving. So for BK Hobbies, you know, you've got Black Friday and Cyber Monday to deal with, and then bam, here's the event. This year, there's an event, but the club is going to run that.
Yeah.
Mr. Gator and Mr. Watts are going to run that. So I spent Thanksgiving at Disney World having a nice meal.
You know, it's funny because 1 year before the blowout, I think I remember Black Friday, Cyber Monday, like Thanksgiving weekend was two weekends ahead of the event. Like in this particular case, right, Thanksgiving was this past weekend. The event is not until the following weekend. So there was like a weekend in between, like almost 2 weeks. But there was a year when we did the blowout, and I cannot remember what year it was. It could have been like, I don't know, 14, 13, whatever. It was that same weekend. So it was like Cyber Monday was that Monday, and we had to get ready for the event literally as of Tuesday, Wednesday.
Yep.
Man, that was...
Yeah, I remember Steve McFall beat us up about that pretty good because he had to drive down here after Cyber Monday.
Yeah. But you know what? I'm happy that... I'm really, truly happy that we don't have to run it. Are you happy?
I'm very happy.
And it was so much work that I remember every year I kept going at it because I felt bad to tell Carrie I'm done. And I'm sure Carrie was thinking the same thing. Well, I don't want to tell Bert I'm done. So it was just like finally we kind of went like, dude, are you really happy doing this shit? And he's like, well, not really. I'm kind of done. I'm like, yeah, I am too. Well, good for both of us.
What made it great was all the people. I mean, we got to meet a lot of people. The vendor support was just incredible. So many people supported us in so many ways. We would never be able to do that event without all of that support. So I really enjoyed all of that. It was just a tremendous amount of work.
No question. Yeah. I mean, it was, you know, looking back, I don't regret any bit of it. And, you know, I kind of feel bad almost that we've dropped it. But, yeah, we had a solid 10-year run. Nobody's saying that nothing will happen again. But it's a good opportunity for the club to take control of an event and run it and see what happens. You know, it's going to be less commercialized, more laid back. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, right?
It'll be fun. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
Not worried, but...
Nowhere does it say there will never be another OHB.
Correct. I agree. So, Carrie, let's start Let's start where we need to start. How did you even get into the hobby? Let's start with that first, because there's a lot to talk about.
Well, this is going to go way back. When I was about 8 years old, 1965, my dad brings home a set of World Book encyclopedias, which I'm sure today no one has any idea what that is. But at the time, it was the Google of the time. If you wanted to know something, you went and looked in the World Book.
And they were expensive, too. They were big sets of books, right? Yeah. And they're like really thick and like about everything, right? Yeah.
Each volume was a letter.
Yeah.
And lo and behold, volume H had a big section of helicopters in it. It was all color with, you know, all sorts of overlays and things that explained all of this. And I was just fascinated.
But it was helicopters in general, not RC. Helicopters. Yeah.
That was before there was any commercial RC product at that time.
Yeah.
I was just fascinated by how something as big as a rotor blade could turn that fast and move that much. Because one of the things the article illustrated was how it's moving pretty much constantly.
Yeah.
And, you know, the concept of a swash plate was something as an 8 year old I couldn't understand. So I was fascinated by this. After that, you know, everything I could read or look at about helicopters, you know, I was all in.
Nice.
So look, going forward a few years later, I learned to fly model airplanes, RC model airplanes. Nothing special, you know, ARF kind of stuff.
Nothing here in Florida?
No, that was in Louisiana.
Louisiana, yeah, you're originally from Louisiana, correct?
I'm originally from Baton Rouge.
Yeah.
So a few years later, I'm looking in the RC Modeler magazine, another dinosaur that no longer exists, but at the time was, you know, like, the only thing you looked at. It was a 150-page magazine every month. It had everything in it. So I open it up one day, and lo and behold, here is Franz Kavan's Jet Ranger. It's a commercial fiberglass, flybarless scale helicopter.
Flybarless.
But flybarless meaning no flight controller, meaning just nothing.
It was collective pitch, all mechanical. Nice. No gyro, nothing.
Awesome.
But it was all fiberglass, so, you know, I'm looking at it going, I'm a kid. I don't know if I can build this. I don't know anything about fiberglass. But it turns out you could order the instruction book for it. So I order this thing, and I get it. And I'm looking through it, and I'm just fascinated. You know, this is cool. But I realize I can't build this. It requires too much fiberglass work and adhering wood to it. I can't do this.
So, how old are you by this time?
I was probably...
Your teens?
That was 1972. I was probably 12, 13, something like that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Somewhere in there.
Oh, my God.
The two really interesting parts about that book, though, were there was a photograph of how to track the rotor blades. And the proven method to do this was to grab a hold of the tail boom with your hand, hover the model with the rotor blades less than 2 feet from your head, and you colored each end so you could see which one was out of track. You set it down and tracked it and tried it again.
Oh, my God. How big were the blades on this particular thing?
It was a 60-size model. I mean,
so it was
it's about 3 feet long.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a pretty good size model. I mean, this thing's screaming. It's a nitro model, so it's going pretty good. And, you know, just looking at that, it's like, nah, I'm not going to do this. But that was the accepted method for years.
Yeah, absolutely.
The other interesting thing in that package was he created what may have been the first gyro. It was an electric mechanism. It had two spinning wheels on it, no case. It was just exposed gyro that supposedly you could use to control the tail, but you had to completely solder it all in. There were no connectors. There were nothing. It was just, here's a gyro. You figure it out.
Really?
Wow.
So obviously, you know, Jet Ranger was not going to work out for me. But a couple of years later, they came out with something called an Alouette. This was mostly plastic and metal with just a little bit of wood. I was able to build this. And it was a 40-size model, so you put a 40-size engine, the nitro engine in it.
40, huh?
A 40, yeah.
Wow. I never even heard of a 40.
No, never.
Like, for RC airplanes, yes, I did, because I flew 40s in the early 80s when I started flying RC, right? I was like in my early teens, not even like 11, 12 years old. There were 40s, but never even heard of it for a helicopter. Hmm. And this is now in the 70s, right? Still in the
70s. Oh, yeah, it's in the 70s, yeah.
Yeah.
And lo and behold...
You built this thing? You built this?
I built it. And lo and behold, I'm going to be cool. I go get a Webra Schnurl engine, which is the coolest, most powerful thing ever, which the model was not designed to take. So I had to do all kind of modifications to it to even get it in the model. And as a result, it was belt drive, and the belt was too tight, and there was nothing I could do about it. So it would start, but it wouldn't run. It never ran.
So it never flew.
It never flew. So I took it apart and put
it... Did it spool up at all?
No, nothing. It wouldn't even run long enough to do that. So I took it apart and put it in a box. And funny enough, about 10 years ago, a guy named John Benario, who you may know, bought that model from me, and he may have built it. I don't know. Maybe he flew
it. You still had it. You held on to it.
I kept two models, and I'll get to the second one here just in a second. So never got this to work. Lo and behold, once again, RC modeler, what appears? A Dubro Shark helicopter. Ran on an O&R gasoline engine that used a glow plug, not a spark plug. It was a one-horsepower engine. So I'm looking at this thing going, I can build this. This is all metal. It's steel, aluminum. The gears are steel. This thing weighed about, I don't know, 15, 16 pounds. It was huge and heavy, but it was pretty straightforward to build. And so I get it built, and it actually works. You know, it'll spool up. It'll lift off.
It's fixed. Were you able to hover it, though?
It's fixed pitch.
Were you able to hover it?
So, fixed pitch.
He's ignoring my question.
You guys have flown fixed pitch, right? You got to lead the fixed pitch a lot. So what would happen was I'd take it out in the backyard. I had a big backyard. Spin it up. Starts to lift off. All of a sudden, it's 30 feet in the air. And so I pull the throttle back. What does it do? Comes down, hits the ground. Immediately, gyroscopic precession, flips it over, tears it up. I did that over and over and over again.
And you kept fixing it.
I kept fixing it. Fortunately, I had a job, so I was pouring all my money into this damn thing. So they come up with a landing gear for it. It's a tripod. It's made out of fiberglass sticks with rubber balls on it. Holds it up.
Kind of like training gear, almost.
It was training gear. Yeah. Holds it up off the ground. It also has these sticks that go out at a 45-degree angle upward in all directions.
Why?
So you couldn't tip it over.
That's not a bad idea for a newbie, because think about it. If now you're limiting your the amount of roll you can apply before it forces you back into a forced landing kind of thing. A safe yet forced landing. Yeah.
And they were tied together with strings, so you know it couldn't really turn over. Except it could turn over and did regularly. And I still tore it up. So eventually I took it back apart and put it in a box and brought it here with me. A few years later, I discover Schluter, and they had come out just with their Helistar.
And that was still in the 70s. I would say that was the 80s?
Oh, no, this was in the early 80s.
Okay. I was going to say late 70s, but yeah.
No, this was in the early 80s. Now, they had their Heli Boy and some other stuff before that, but... The Superior and the Helistar and later the Champion came out in the 80s. And I had both a Helistar and a Champion. But Helistar, I get this thing, I build it. They have a trainer stand that you anchor the model to. It can lift off. It can pirouette. It can do some side to side and not break it. So I use this to figure out how to set the model up. I got it completely set up, got it built. It works great. I was in New Orleans at that time. Take it out to the field, find the local expert, hand it to him and say, look, tell me what's wrong with it. He lifts it off, flies it around, brings it back, says, there's nothing wrong with it. Here, go learn how to fly it.
Nice. And it actually flew. Flew well.
It flew perfectly. So I learned to fly that, and you know, that kind of started actual flying at that point. Yeah. And I had some other models. I had a Champion.
So, Kerry, this is 10 years into your first experience, right?
Yep.
When you actually got the helicopter flying.
Yeah. Which was...
It's not unusual for this time. It's not unusual for those times. people are spoiled nowadays because they get a helicopter and they learn to fly within a matter of a couple weeks. But
or they have a simulator and they yeah, learn before correct. They ever have one.
There were no computers then that could handle a simulator. There were no simulators, to say the least. So, yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Very interesting.
Now, people learn to fly because they would either come to visit Walt Scunard or Walt Scunard would go to an event and teach somebody how to fly.
Or Ernie Huber.
Or Ernie Huber. Yeah. Ernie Huber came along a little bit later.
Rest in peace. Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
So how did things evolve from that point on? What was the next thing, or what was the first model that people that are listening, the audience, could relate to, was in terms of something that's more recent?
So around 1985, Miniature Aircraft, who was the importer of Schluter, started working on their XL. Mm-hmm. And around 86, they started producing the model. And I actually had one of the first 500 of them, which I totally destroyed. It was the bent frame model, right. And, you know, it was a nice flying model. And they had a lot of success with that. They produced, I think, over 25,000 of those things over time. It was a
lot. Different times now, huh? Different times now, that's for sure. It takes a lot for a manufacturer to even come close to those numbers anymore. But, yeah.
So a little bit later, somewhere around 1995 or six, Miniature Aircraft decides they're going to take an airplane engine, a gasoline airplane engine, and put it in an XL. So they found a Zenoa engine. It was a 23cc engine, and they put this thing in a model. They used the same fan that they used on all the Nitro models, which was a mistake. And then they, of course, the fan shrouds that they have wouldn't fit, so they were molding them. I suspect Bob Bice was hand molding them out of fiberglass, which was not temperature resistant, so they melted because they got really, really hot. And so this was, you know, the first commercial gas helicopter that was really available. And as a kid, I was always fooling around with engines, so I loved
engines. Okay, so this is a segue into gas helicopters, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what... You want to ask the question, Kyle? What got you into how did that transition happen from glow or nitro into gas?
So around 1990, I decided, you know what, I can probably make this thing work because I understand two-stroke engines and I've got a lot of history fooling around with engines, and I can fly the helicopter, so I want to try this thing. And I actually bought a used XL from Peter Wales, which he was selling, and did some work on it and got it working. And I fixed the problems, you know, the heat problem, the clutch problems, all that stuff, I fixed it. There were ways to fix it, and I got it fixed. And that model flew really well. In fact, I campaigned it in AMA contests for a while and actually got wood with it one year. So it flew really well.
Hmm. Nice.
That kind of started the journey, you know, into gas helicopters. I had that for a very long time. And a few years later, a guy named Ali Azar started a company called Helibug. And Helibug was making conversions for traditional electric or gas or glow-powered helicopters. And this was something that was, you know, there was only one other person in the world doing this, and he was making junk. It was garbage. He didn't support it. He was ripping people off. He had a really bad reputation. Helibug stuff worked. There were some issues with it, but you could convert models and it worked. So I got a couple of those and, you know, flew them. I had a T-Rex version.
This is in the 2000s now.
Yeah.
Because I remember Helibug, yeah.
You actually flew this, the 600 size, in one of your...
when we did an episode for Smack Talk with Al, yes.
Yep, did a Smack Talk episode and flew it.
Yeah.
It actually had plenty of power. It was just too heavy for what it was.
Yeah.
So, interesting. So one of the early ones was a 600 size, not exactly a 700 size one.
The first Helibug was a 600, yes. And really? Then he moved on to the 700s.
What motor did the 600 one have?
They both used the same motor we all use today, which is a Zenoa RC engine.
Wow.
He was using the 240, which at that time was a 22.5cc engine. But that motor still exists today.
So I'm curious about where is your fascination with gas power coming from? Tell us about this. Like, there's got to be a reason. Because you're all about gas. You could give a shit about electric or nitro.
I don't have a single electric helicopter.
Correct. Explain.
I do have some nitro helicopters.
Yeah, but where does that come from, though? Like, where did you develop this crazy fascination, curiosity, or whatever it is, or I don't know, interest in gas?
I guess it goes back again to being a kid when I was always fooling with, you know, lawnmower engines and stuff like that. As a little kid, I'm taking apart and putting together, and I'm just...
Is it just the internals of gas, IC gas engine that...
To some degree, it was something that I could do, I could make work. Not many other people could, so I could I could make some contributions to the hobby there.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that time, up until just a few years ago, a major problem was there were shysters in the business. They would sell you on things to make you think you were getting the best thing ever, and it was junk. And they would take a lot of money from you, and it wouldn't work, and then you'd be frustrated, and you'd walk away going, cheap gas helicopters are garbage.
Yeah.
I'm never going to do that. And I knew I could make a difference with that.
Mm-hmm. So from the early gassers with the Helibug to what we have now, like, what are the advancements that you've seen from then to now?
The engines have gotten a lot more powerful. Mm-hmm. The exhaust systems are custom made to help make more power. The models are both lighter and heavier. Sort of depends on which way you go there. Mm. Clearly, the models themselves are much more robust. I mean, the models that we convert, the Goblins, the Synergies, the T-Rexes, these are all, you know, top-of-the-line models.
Mm-hmm.
So you're starting off with a top-of-the-line model, and you're just kind of swapping out the bottom part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Makes sense.
So if you could sell someone on a gas-powered helicopter, what would be your selling point? I know that's a tricky question, but...
Well, so there's actually several advantages. They're clean. You know, if you like to fly nitro, you're going to have spule all over it.
Slimers, as I call them.
You're going to have slime all over it. There is no slime. You know, they stay perfectly clean. In fact, you have to oil them because they're like an electric. They're not spuling, so
yeah,
you're not going to get that stuff. They're really cheap to run. You know, you mm-hmm. fly a 700-class model, a flight's going to cost you around $4.50 if you're running 30% nitro.
Mm-hmm.
Gas helicopter, 45 cents.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll fly twice as long.
And this is particularly important for those, for people living in countries where the nitro is cost prohibited. Some places in Europe and so forth where, you know, they're spending upwards of $60, $70 for a gallon of nitro.
Isn't that crazy?
It's ridiculous.
Whereas they can get gasoline, I think, in most of Europe is what, is it? I might be off on this, but I think it's in the range of €1.50 a liter. So I might be off on this. It's been a while. Maybe between 1 and 2 euros a liter. So that's €8 for a gallon. So $10 a gallon per se. Just it might be less, might be more, but. That's significantly cheaper than
and your flight time is roughly double. So, you know, it's not unusual to get 15 minutes out of a tank.
What do you do for 15 minutes?
Well, that's up to you. To be fair, most people fly at about 6 or 8 minutes and land it.
Right.
And then they don't have to fill it back up. They can just start it back when they're ready to fly and keep going.
Unless you're Raja and you grab a chair and you sit on the flight line.
So the story is less expensive, and you know, people argue that the power is just not there. But with that said, I think that for 90% of the population, or 75%, or whatever percentage we want to assign, it's more than enough power. And if anything, I think it actually helps them because it teaches them collective management.
That's the number one selling point from a flying perspective. If you can do, you know, somewhat radical aerobatics with a gas helicopter, you've got really good collective control. So mm-hmm. if you want to go fly something else, you're going to be, you know, already a star at that.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt.
Makes sense. So go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go.
Well, what I was going to ask is, so say someone has an interest in gassers, what's the best way for them to kind of get into it? Or should I talk to you, or is there a specific model that they should look at, or?
Well, we would certainly be happy to talk to somebody about their interest. There's really two categories of these things these days. There's a conversion, or there's out of the box ready for gas. As we sit here, there's only one model in the world still in production that's ready for gas, and that is the XL Whiplash. Mm-hmm. Mr. Bergen still makes some models. They're kind of custom ordered. They're not widely available. If you call him and ask him to build you one, he will. Yeah. You can't go to the hobby store and buy one.
And this is Chris Bergen.
Chris Bergen,
yeah. Does he have a website? Do you know? You happen to know?
I think so. I think BergenRC.com is
BergenRC, yeah. BergenRC.com.
He's doing a lot of industrial and commercial stuff.
Yeah. He's one of our customers. Pretty nice dude. I've known him for a long time. Yeah, Chris. Nice guy.
Hmm. Yeah, they custom make twin-cylinder gas engines. They custom make the engine.
Mm-hmm. Ooh.
Because they're carrying, you know, really heavy loads with it.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, he uses our servos, so. Yeah,
good.
Nice guy. I've known him for a long time. I think he gave me the waiver for turbine, maybe? I'm not sure.
I think he did. Yeah. I think he signed it.
So for rotary turbine, so.
So one of these two options is really all you've got. To be the most successful, find somebody in your area that flies something. You know, whatever it is they're flying, if that's going to be your first model, I would highly suggest you buy whatever they're flying, because they're going to know how it flies, they're going to know how to tune it, they're mm-hmm. going to know what's wrong with it.
Now, when it comes to gas helicopters, like, contrary to popular belief, you cannot just get, or you could, but it's not recommended that you just get an out-of-the-box engine, correct?
I would not recommend a stock engine under any circumstances, because they are not balanced. The, mm-hmm. In fact, the crankshaft may not even be straight. It's an industrial engine. You know, they're mm-hmm. weed-eater engines, basically.
Right.
And they do the best they can. They're mass-produced. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I would highly recommend, if you're going to do this, especially the larger it gets in displacement, that you, in fact, either buy it from a tuner or you send it to a tuner. And there's really two tuners left. A company called B.H. Hansen, which is up in, I think he's in Pennsylvania, and TRM Power, which is here in the Orlando area.
Mm-hmm.
I deal exclusively with TRM for a number of reasons, not the least of which it's he will custom make an engine to whatever you want. You tell him what you're going to do with it.
Knowledgeable guy, sweetheart, awesome dude, awesome guy.
He's a really nice guy.
Yeah, no doubt.
He's one of these guys that his goal is to make a contribution to the hobby. That's really what he wants to do.
Yeah.
And he goes out of his way to support this. He does lifetime warranties on the engines.
Yeah.
He really goes far and away to make the best engine.
So if somebody buys some kind of goblin, they buy a conversion, say, from you, for example, and then they buy a Zenoa engine and they want to send it into TRM for to have it balanced and so forth, what are they looking at in terms of turnaround time, roughly, and cost to have it modified? Do you know?
Well, we offer the engines out of the box. So okay. Depending on which version, we sell them.
Sort of interrupt you, but the best way to do it then is just to buy the engine already from you guys, from you or from TRM or whatever, instead of just buying an engine and sending it in, right?
Yeah, we do one-stop shopping. I mean, we got the conversion. In some cases, I got the helicopter. If you want a Goblin or an Agile, I keep those in stock. I usually keep some of the Synergies in stock, too. So if you want the whole helicopter, I can sell you the whole thing. We keep the engines. We keep exhaust systems. We can get electronics.
Yeah.
We're kind of a one-stop gig for that.
Hmm.
But far and away, that's the easiest way to do it. Just buy it pre-converted. Otherwise, you know, an engine is about $230. And depending on what spec you want Al to do it, he's going to charge you a couple hundred dollars at least. So the least expensive engine we sell is $429, and the most expensive is $540. And that's got anodized special custom parts on it. So we call it our special edition.
And the website is gas-powered-helicopters.com.
Yep.
Cool.
So when it comes to setup, Kerry, obviously you're going to need like a governor and a governor sensor and all that. How does the setup for a gasser machine change compared to like a nitro?
Well, you can do it the same way. Some people put magnets in the main gear and put a standard sensor pickup off the main gear. Mm-hmm. You can put it in the clutch bell, depending on which model it is. What we have is a sensor pickup. You actually take the back off the engine and you install it inside the fan housing, pointed right at the magnets on the fan.
Yeah.
And that's how you pick it up. It's that simple.
What about a gator stator? Those exist still?
They still exist. They're hard to get. I stopped using them or selling them because the explosion in flybarless units and governors, they couldn't keep up. It was designed for a Futaba system, and it works wonderful with a Futaba system.
And for the people that know what it is, that's some sort of electronic device that works with the ignition, right?
It basically plugged into the ignition coil,
yeah.
And there's pulses off that coil that come off the kill switch wires, and it just reads those and converts them into an analog signal.
So it worked with a Futaba governor like one of the older Futaba governors or even
GV1,
the newer?
GV1 750. It'll work with the 760. You have to make some wiring modifications, but it'll work with a Neo. It works with V-bar too. Work with a Spartan. Again, you have to make some voltage modifications. Changes, yeah. But yeah. Too many people wanted to use, off-brand governors, and it doesn't support that. So what we went to was just the bracket that you install inside the engine, and it'll work with anything. If you got a sensor pickup, it'll work with your governor.
Nice.
Wow. Nice. Not bad.
So I think you answered this already, but maybe we asked the question more in a more straightforward fashion. What are the most significant advancements that you've seen with gas helicopters in recent years, or in the last few years, or in the lifetime of gas helicopters?
Well, clearly the models have become more durable because the models they're based on have become more durable.
Correct.
Engines are more reliable, better balanced, and make more power. There's custom-made exhaust systems now that not only increase power, but reduce the amount of sound. The most significant advancement I've seen recently is there's a guy in Greece running a company called Blackout Mods, and he has developed a conversion for the T-Rex 700X, and it's all carbon fiber, entirely carbon fiber. And when you build the model, it will be ready to fly at 12 pounds.
Wow.
Doug Darby brought one of these out to the Southwestern Heli Fly.
Yeah, I've seen, I haven't actually, I have to be blunt and honest, but I haven't seen the videos, but I've seen the posts where he's posted videos of Ben Storick flying, and I haven't really had a chance to click and watch, but I've heard that, it's a different animal, isn't it?
That model's running a tune pipe, which is good for at least another 1.5 horsepower. And, the model weighs 12 pounds with fuel in it. That's sort of in the same category as...
That puts it in line with a nitro.
Right.
Nitro machine.
Pretty close, yeah.
But it's double the displacement because, a 105 is a 105, and these are 24.5 cc's, so...
Yeah. So... What is the most popular gas helicopter available to the market today?
Ready to fly, there's only one. That's the...
No. Like, period. Like, conversion, not conversion, whatever it is. What do you sell the most, or what do you think? This is all subjective. We're not pitching any manufacturer. I'm just curious, in your opinion, what do you think is the most popular gas-powered conversion helicopter, anything, period?
I would be willing to bet there are more XL-1005 gas helicopters, the original, than anything else out there.
The original, yeah.
Because they sold a lot of those.
Yeah, yeah.
I've sold more Goblins than anything else.
As far as conversions.
As far as conversions.
Interesting.
Why do you think that is?
Well, it's been out the longest. That we brought that out 4 years ago. And hey, Goblin's a very popular helicopter.
It's a popular helicopter. And it's a simple helicopter, really, in the big scheme of things. Like, it's super simple, yeah.
It's very simple to convert. And it's durable. I mean, they hold up. They're tough to tear up. An interesting problem I've got is our conversions are pretty well designed. They're durable. You can smash them into the ground, and they don't really break. So I don't sell very many parts.
And well, one of the questions we had written down, which you already answered, is like, do you think it's viable for someone to get reasonable, similar performance out of a gasser compared to a natural heli? And I guess we just talked about that when you mentioned.
You can get there, but you've got to really work at it. You know, you've got to do, you got to have a special engine, a special exhaust. You've got to have something like this T-Rex conversion that's really light. It's pretty close. You look at that video, it's not bad.
Yeah. But it takes a lot of work, time, and effort.
Yeah.
And the bottom line is, this is my personal opinion. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think that for the people that want to go into a gas-powered, and, you know, we've gone over this many times. We did a Smack Talk episode with you and Al from TRM about this. I feel like gas is a great platform for people that want something inexpensive, simple. They can go out and fly and practice. I don't think that, not to say that you cannot get performance, but I just don't think that a performance-oriented person is going to go after this. This is for somebody that wants to practice, wants something that's cheap to fly. They can go time and time and time and time again without cleaning, without messing with it. And they like the whole thing of running an IC engine instead of an electric, you know, and not having to charge and not having to deal with that. So somebody like Raja that goes out there and flies for 45 minutes at a time, he just wants to fly. He's a great pilot, not to say absolutely anything bad about Raja. He's a very good pilot, but he's not doing crazy TikToks and Heart 3D. He's just, he's flying. He's doing Sport 3D, sport flying. He's doing some funnels, some stuff like that. He does 100 autos in every flight, and he truly loves and enjoys flying. I think for that purpose, you can't beat it because you can't get that kind of flight time out of any electric, no matter how hard you try. Don't you agree? Like, that's how I see it. Like, it's got its own place.
He also runs a generator on that model, so yes, you never have to charge it. So as long as it's got fuel in it, it will fly.
That's ridiculous. Good for him.
Yeah. Tell us about this generator very briefly. Like, how does that work?
Well, we actually, TRM actually makes one now, so we sell this as well. It's a small electric motor. In our case, it's a Scorpion, and you mount it on top of the engine shaft. In this case, it's the clutch start shaft, and it feeds into a regulator. Then you can, it's actually a castle regulator in our case, so you can set the voltage from anywhere from 4 to 14 volts, and you plug it into your battery pack, and as long as the engine's running, it's charging it.
Is it putting enough charge onto the pack to keep you going? Absolutely. Regardless? So you don't ever have to charge?
As long as you adjust the voltage, and you, it takes a little bit of tuning here.
Yeah.
You got to find out how much current you're taking out of the pack for a flight, and then adjust the voltage of the regulator such that when you're done flying, it's fully charged.
It's almost like an even trade.
It's an even trade, right? Hmm. So if you tinker with the voltage, yeah, you can keep it fully charged.
I should do that. You should give me a regulator and a gas helicopter so I can fly like Raja.
There you go.
Well, you could put this on a nitro or a even an electric if you wanted to. It's not going to charge those big batteries, but it'll charge a receiver pack, no problem.
Very interesting.
But to your point, if you're planning on winning XFC, you are not going to bring a gas helicopter to do it.
Not yet.
Probably never.
At least he's honest.
I don't think so. I mean, there's the engines weigh what they weigh.
Right.
We've got a prototype engine that weighs a pound less, and we'll see where that goes. It's custom made. TRM will make it. Again, it weighs a pound less. Same engine, basically.
So steering things in a different direction. Back to torches. We understand that you are one of the founding members, if not the founding member. So talk to us about starting the Torches Club here in Orlando.
So I got here in 1986, and I was flying XLs.
Straight to Orlando.
Straight to Orlando, right. Actually worked in a place called Maitland. But so we used to fly behind miniature aircraft, and Cliff Hyatt flew there. I don't know if you,
yeah,
you guys know who Cliff is. Mm-hmm. Past F3C world champion. Still an incredible pilot. He doesn't fly as much, but he's just...
His son, Daniel, was doing F3C in the Worlds, I believe, up until last year, too. Yeah, so, yeah.
Doing really well.
Yeah, he's been out of the country for work, so I don't think he's on this team. But
he's been on a hiatus for a little bit. He was on the SAB Goblin team, and he got a hold of us that he's been busy, and he might make, you know, he might get back into it later. But, yeah, he's got commitments. He's
a very good pilot.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. No doubt.
So anyway, Cliff and I used to fly not only behind miniature aircraft, but various places around town. And somehow we just got this wild hair of, hey, let's have a helicopter club. And so we created these little flyers that we took to every hobby shop, which there used to be a lot of hobby shops around here. There's not very many now, but there used to be a lot.
Yeah.
Brought it to every hobby shop, said we're going to have a meeting, show up in about 40 or 50 people showed up.
Wow.
And, you know, we started the club in 1988. It incorporated and exists to this day.
1988. That's the year I graduated high school.
Thanks.
Kyle wasn't born, even thought of being born.
Not even a thought.
It was over a decade before
his
parents even thought about doing the thing. But anyway, 1988, Torches. The Orlando Radio Control Helicopter Society.
Yep.
And you set it up. Were you at the light tower at the water tower at that time?
No, that was pre-water tower. We were actually flying in Winter Garden at the water processing plant out there.
Okay.
Right on Lake Apopka. Mm-hmm. It was about the same size as the water tower area, but
and it was north of where it is today.
It was west of where it is.
Oh, west. Then it got moved to a place we used to call the water tower,
right?
Which was a very small, relatively small field, much smaller than where we're at today.
Yes.
And then it was there for several years, right? A long time.
Until we were thrown off because of an event with a neighbor. They built houses around it, and somebody did something stupid, and we got thrown off.
And that was in perhaps 2003? 2002 or 3.
That I don't know the answer to.
I would say 3. Hmm. And then got moved to its present location at 4225 South Akoya Popka Road, where we've been holding the blowout for the last few years.
And we got that site because our president at the time lived next door to the mayor of the city. And the mayor saw him flying it in his backyard and said, hey, you know, we got property
there. And that was Steve?
No, it wasn't Steve. It was Mike Zeller.
Mike Zeller. Hmm. So Torches has survived for a long time. I mean, Jesus, that's 30 years.
Thanks.
that's 30 years, and it's still alive and kicking. And I joined Torches, I would say, about 14 or 15 years ago. And I've seen Torches go from having about 40 members to having over 140 to 150 members, back down to 50 or 60 members, I think, we're holding today. So it's a good accomplishment. It's the only, I remember when I started the hobby back in the early, when I started the RC, the helicopter side of the hobby in the early 2000s, Torches was the only, or one of the only, if not the only RC helicopter only club in Florida, and maybe even in the United States. Because there's a lot of clubs, and they're, you know, planes, helis, whatever else it is, but Torches was helicopter only, which was really cool because it gave everybody an opportunity to just share the same passion and fly together. Whereas, I don't want to be rude, but when you go to a club where there's planes and helis, you know, sometimes things don't mix very well, and it's a little bit of drama and a lot of stuff going on. But Torches is always historically been a helicopter-only club, and that's really cool.
It's in the bylaws.
Yeah.
For years, it was very explicit. There will be no airplanes.
Why?
Because, to his point, generally things don't mix.
Fair enough.
And it's a different in a different crowd.
And I remember I was part of the board of the board of the club many years ago, maybe a decade ago, when the bylaws were changed and it was allowed to fly airplanes with some restrictions.
Right.
So, yeah. And that's how it stands today. If you have an airplane, you can bring it, you can fly it, but you always have to give the right of way and you always have to give preference to the helicopter. So if you're out there with your Goblin 700 and I have my airplane, I have to land so you can fly. And I think that's fair. I think that's totally cool.
It works out fine.
Yeah.
Don't sell yourself short, though. You had a great deal with the resurrection of this club.
Thank you.
Because shortly before you joined, there were exactly two members, myself and Steve Hathaway. He and I met month after month after month. Walked in, nobody's there. Hang around 15 minutes, go to dinner. That was the club meeting, literally for several years.
Well, it wasn't. I appreciate your words, and I really thank you for it. But I think it was being at the right place at the right time. I think when I joined the club, it was around the time when the hobby was booming. You know, I always call it a cycle, right? We go through the cyclical events, and you know, I've seen. This is the second cycle I see. Now we're at a very, very low. This is perhaps a third. We're a very low end of that cycle. We're struggling to get people into the hobby. And when I joined that club, we were going from a low point to a high point, right? And I remember we reached a lot of members for a while. When I was club president, we have more members we knew what to do with.
We had too many members for quite a while.
Yeah, and too that's many. Why we were forced, after I gave up the presidency to the next person, they were kind of forced to increase the membership dues to kind of wean out some of the people that wanted to create drama.
That's crazy.
That's how it happens. We had too many members.
Too many.
You remember, Kerry, there were times, and this is towards the late 2000s, when if you went to Torches on a Saturday or Sunday, you would not find a place to park.
You ain't flying.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. We had, I don't know, I'm throwing a number out of my butt because I don't know exactly, but maybe 20-some tables, 18 tables, and you had no room to put your helicopter on a table because they were all taken because there were 40 cars parked out there, 40-plus pilots.
That's crazy.
And, it was crazy. Not that way anymore.
No, it's a lot quieter now. But you brought a lot of excitement to the club because you traveled all over the world. You were a good pilot. You were a great pilot. People saw you do things that nobody else in the club could do. And it brought more people in because they knew they could learn. And you brought in other people. Unfortunately, Kyle wasn't here then, so he wasn't.
Well, even if he would have been, he was too young. He was like 10 or 12 or 13.
Just a little guy.
But yeah, that made a big difference and made a significant impact. And, you know, we've been blessed to have people like Mark Graves and Graves RC and people like that, you know, they do this for a living. So they, you know, even though they do have, I'm not saying they don't have a passion for the hobby in itself, but they're constantly motivated to bring in new people, not only because of their natural passion for the hobby, but also because it's their job and they need to make a living, right?
Right.
So it was a good vicious cycle to just keep pushing and pushing and getting new people. And of course, then we started the Orlando Helicopter Blowout together. And like we started it at a different field, ironically, because we couldn't get the right permission to do it at our own Torches field. But indirectly, that was still promoting Torches, because even though it was not taking place at the Torches field, it was a Torches run event. And yeah, and then of course the OHB got moved into Torches, I think in 2010 or 11 perhaps, and that kept helping the club grow. So yeah, it's been a hell of a good run with Torches, and I think Torches is here to stay as long as we keep our field, right?
Yeah, you know, that's always been the big problem, is having a place to fly. I forgot about a couple of other places we flew at. We actually flew in Winter Park for a while on what is now a bunch of apartments, but there was a 40-acre field not far from where I lived that we were there for a while as well. But we've bounced around. We were out at the drag strip out by Christmas for Bithlo. It's in Bithlo. We were out there for years.
Oh, that was, it was, yeah, absolutely. And then after the torches, after the Okoye field was added to the mix of fields, that field was still there.
Right.
We called it the East Field, which Correct. Was by the Drax Strip.
Right.
So for the people not familiar with our area, the east side of Orlando, it's a solid 45-minute drive east from where we're at right now at Torches. We had another field that was by a drag strip. Mm-hmm. And some people used to fly there. Some people used to fly here. When we had all those many members, two fields was the way to go, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, some people preferred to be in the east, and some people lived around the west.
Yeah, yes, so. And then back in the day when I think this could have been 2004 or 5, maybe 5, our club president at the time was some guy from Turkey by the name of Alec Oxit. He ran an event. I think the first event we did was at the East Field.
Mm-hmm.
And Marcus Kim came and did some demos for us and stuff. Yeah. So, yeah, it's long, long history with Torches. Long history. It's cool.
The club's also run some FAI events. We did some team trials.
Absolutely, yeah.
At a place called RC World, which the field's still there. They're not flying there anymore. It got bought to build houses on, and then the builder went bankrupt, and it's just a big empty field now. But it was a nice place to fly.
And Cliff Hyatt, your co-founder, is still on the board, part of the board
yes,
of the
he
club,
is. Right.
But he never shows up. We love you, Cliff, but you don't show up. I haven't seen Cliff in a while.
Cliff, I think, is about to retire from Lockheed Martin,
yeah.
So maybe he will show up more and fly.
He flies in his backyard, though.
He's got his backyard is on a lake, so yeah. He's got
unlimited room,
100 acres to fly over.
Yeah,
nice.
Yeah.
Must be nice.
I don't think he's put one in the lake yet.
So, Kerry, let's change the topic. So, what do you do for a living? Well, I know you're about to stop doing what you do for a living, but it's okay. People probably wonder. What do you do?
So I'm in the IT business. I have been for 45 years now. I've done everything from being a computer operator to being a programmer to being a manager to being an architecture guy to all over the place. And I've actually been here at the same place for a little over 32 years. And the business was sold a couple of months ago, and that's all going to come to an end here in the next week or so.
Very sorry to hear about the news. I don't know how you feel, if you have mixed feelings about it. More than likely, you probably have mixed feelings, right?
It was time to move on.
Yeah.
Our financial plan was to stay there one more year. My wife works there as well, and we're both going to be looking for something to do after next week.
Take some time off for sure.
Yeah, probably so. I mean, we get packages and whatnot, so it's not like I'm going to be out scouring for food at the end of next week, but we'll find something else to do. The helicopter business, my conversion business...
It's not enough to live off of.
It supports itself, but it's certainly... nobody's living off of it. My dog won't live off of it.
Listen, people, this is what Kyle and I say all the time. Nobody's making a killing out of this shit. Nobody. So the people that are doing it because they have a passion. They love it. They enjoy it. Like, personally, I have a background in IT. I worked with Core Routers back in the late 80s, the early 90s. And, you know, it was good business back in the day. And I was making really, really solid money for a long time. And I didn't give it up because I didn't enjoy the money. I wanted the freedom to do what I wanted to do, and I had such a great passion for this hobby, and it was a huge pay cut. But you know what? It came with the reward to know that I was just, number one, doing what I love to do. Number two, not to say I don't like IT. I just didn't like the, you know what I'm talking about.
I know.
I didn't like all the other shit that comes along with it. But not only for the freedom that to do what I love to do, but also because I knew I was contributing to the hobby and helping people. And it was just fun. And but yeah, there's the for anybody that thinks that people are making a lot of money, no,
not at all.
Yeah, when you bitch about your 10 or 20% discount, guys, you're just changing our ability to pay for cable or cell phone service.
Yeah, I don't get beat up too much for not doing sales on any of my stuff, but to be honest, I can't. I mean,
yeah, it's hard.
We kind of did surveys to find out how much would people be willing to pay for, you know, conversions or for gas helicopters. And in the quantities that we make them, they're very expensive to make.
Yeah.
You know, until you make 300 or 500 parts at a time,
yeah,
they're really expensive.
Yeah, you're making 50 or something, you have no margin. You have to sell it very expensive.
Correct. Yeah. And some things are unmakeable, like fan shrouds, for example. Mm-hmm. Fan shroud number one will cost about $5,000.
Damn. Yeah,
the second one is cheap, but yeah, the first one costs you $5,000.
A lot of people underestimate that. Like I've gone over this conversation with Kyle recently because we've been talking about, some people a lot of people have been asking SAB to do a 570 nitro. And, you know, I really don't want to discuss this too much, but it's interesting to give people some perspective on this. To develop a nitro helicopter, you have to make a few plastic parts. You can't make a fan shroud out of aluminum or CNC. You can't CNC cut it. You can't make you could do an aluminum fan, which is more expensive, but the way to do it is to do it in plastic, right? And then you need a fuel tank. You need a few parts that are made out of plastic. And each mold costs upwards of $5,000 or more, sometimes $8,000. It depends on how intricate of a design you have. So after you've made the first one, then the next one is going to cost you $1 or $1.50 or 50 cents, depending on volume, right?
But first one hurts.
But the first one. So you'd have to make 500 or 1,000. You know, I think the break-even point for SAB is like in the 300s. It's a lot. So if you cannot sell 500 or more, it's not worth doing it because it takes an incredible amount of work. And you're barely breaking even at 300, right? So after you've devoted, you know, hundreds and hundreds of hours and all this money and all this risk, you have to get something in return. And you got to move a lot of product. It's not easy. It's very difficult. Very difficult.
I can generally break even in lots of about 50. More than that, it's not any cheaper. It's just you're spending more money.
Yeah, you're making a little bit at that point. Not much, but a little bit. Yeah,
we're basically breaking even.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, I'm not in this for the money at this point because I've had other means of employment, and hopefully we can keep this going and kind of keep it, paying for itself, which is really all I need. But to your point about plastic parts, you know, look at this new Mikado, this Glogo thing they're doing. Mm. They're buying parts from other manufacturers to make that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
true.
And it's a good plan because A, the person they're buying it from wants to sell them. They're going to make some money.
Yeah, they don't have to like source a completely new mold and spend the tens of thousands perhaps for the two or three, four parts they have to mold. Right. They just go straight to somebody else that, you know, they pay more per piece, but overall they're paying a lot less.
In the long term, they're paying a lot less.
So what's your typical day? I know things are going to change in the next week or two, but what's your typical day? You go to work, and how do you ship orders? When do you ship them?
I do that at night or on weekends.
So what about if I order something today at 2 o'clock? I want to ship before 3.
If I have it in stock, it will ship tomorrow.
Okay, that's not bad.
If I have to make the kit, it may take a day or so.
Okay, that's not bad.
Because as I was telling Kyle a bit earlier, I don't have the luxury of just go pulling the bag off the shelf. You know, I have racks of nuts and bolts and engine mounts.
Oh, so you're bagging and tagging everything as you ship.
We build the entire kit from scratch. Now, sometimes I build, you know, some surplus, but generally I build them to order. I've just got racks of parts.
Yeah.
And it takes about an hour and a half to do a Goblin, a couple hours to do a Synergy, and the 570s that we've done in the past take a couple hours. There's a lot of parts in that model.
So before we call it quits, you have not only done gas conversions, you've done nitro conversions.
We've done one officially, and we'll probably have another one here very soon.
Okay, before you get into the other one, because I don't know if you want to talk about that, but you've done one, which is the is a Goblin 570, correct?
Correct, and it was originally designed to work with the OS Max GT15 gas engine. There have been a number of issues with that engine as it was delivered from the factory. We made a bunch of modifications to it. We've got a custom-made cooling head for it. We make changes inside of it. I actually offer a sport version of it off the shelf that has all these upgrades in it. And so early next year, OS is going to have a new version of it with a blue head on it that has, basically, they almost copied our head and made a lot of the internal changes. So it's going to be very similar. I've got one of those to test. I'm going to see how it holds up in the model.
So because it was originally made for that engine, then obviously a 91 drops in.
Right in.
Yeah.
And I always thought, you know, it would really be perfect for the older 60 size engine. That would be wonderful. Of course, they don't make that anymore. So the next engine up is the 90s. But most people put 105s in them, and that's a lot of engine for a 570.
It's a lot of engine for that heli. So you want to talk about the new project?
So we've got a prototype of a 570 that will fly with an OS 55 or a YS 60 engine in it. Mm-hmm. You guys have both flown it. Mm-hmm. You've seen it. It needs to be tested a little bit more to make sure you guys can't blow it up.
I think it's great. I honestly think is a very, very solid conversion. The only reason why I say this is I was not a fan of the 570 on a 91. I know a lot of people want a lot of power, and it's like putting a freaking, I don't know, 8-cylinder engine on a little
tractor
on a Prius or something. But I think this is made for it. It's the perfect combination of power and size. It's the right weight. Don't you agree, Carrie? I think this will appeal more to the mass audience. It's a nitro, which people have. In recent times, we've seen an increase in demand for nitro. People are more interested in nitro. It's a cheap nitro, economical, because it's a 50 or 55. Mm-hmm. And it fits the perfect model, 570, you know? It's almost up there with a Synergy 556, or, you know, it's just the right size. It's a little bit smaller than a 600, but right in line with the power-to-weight ratio, I feel like it's spot on, right?
I suspect with the drive ratio that you need to get the head speed up, it's going to fly better with shorter than 570 blades. We're going to try it with those with your 550s to see how that works.
553s, yeah. Yeah. You got the last set.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we're getting more, but for now. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to put those in there, and hopefully you guys can get a pull on it and see what you think. And
yeah.
I'm sure
you got a set. This is not for sale, but I got a set on another heli that I can remove and try myself too. So
I think it's cool. It's really cool. It's a nice size.
Based on your guys' feedback, I hope to make that available in limited quantities next year.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
Pretty sweet.
Very cool. Uncle Ron, you need to buy one.
He needs even numbers, so he needs at least two or four of them.
Nice. Well, thank you, Carrie.
Thanks very much for having
me,
guys.
It's been good. Yeah, so, Carrie, if people have questions for you, they need to get a hold of you, whatever, where would they reach you at?
Well, the store has a email address, info@gas-power-helicopters.com. Mm-hmm. You can email me directly at carrie.shirley@gmail.com. We have a Facebook page. We have several Facebook pages. Gas-powered thoughts, gas-powered helicopters, and there's actually a group now in Facebook called Gas-Powered Helicopters.
I saw that. Yeah.
Where people have kind of.
How do you find time to do all that shit? It's crazy. No way.
It doesn't take that much time.
Okay.
I'm not like you, man. I don't have 1,000 orders a day to fill.
Yeah. Whatever. What about you, Mr. Stacy?
Facebook.com/KyleStacyRC.
Nice. You guys can get a hold of us at Facebook.com/TheBKOfficial or Instagram, TheBKOfficial. I can be reached at Facebook.com/BirdRC. or Instagram, Bert_Kammer. Thank you again, Shirley.
Shirley.
Thanks, Bert.
Mr. Shirley. Thanks a lot, Carrie. We appreciate it, man. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. You'll hear us again next week.
Next week.
Hope you enjoy.